You're listening to Gossip Int, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Int is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today, we have Karen Frost and Caitlin Hopkins. Karen Frost is a senior threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ, a Microsoft company. Previously, she spent 11 years working in the federal government, and for the last 6 years, she's also been a freelance pop culture journalist. Caitlin Hopkins is a threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ. She has her master's degree in applied intelligence and has spent 4 years in analytic positions working for the government and private sector. And I'm Diana Duviel. I'm a senior threat intelligence analyst here at RiskIQ, and I spent 10 years as an analyst in the federal government. Although all three of our participants today work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone, and they do not represent the views of Microsoft. This week's topic is signposts and indicators. Signposts of change, or indicators, is an incredibly useful technique. It's used to help us overcome our cognitive biases, to spot emerging trends, or identify unanticipated change. To use this technique, we create a list of signposts or observable events that you would expect to see if a postulated situation is developing. So, for example, a classic situation might be signposts that an enemy is preparing for war. You could think of military units mobilizing to the border, ammunition production increasing, etc. Now, going through this exercise to create an objective list of signposts can be particularly helpful in a situation where there are sharply divided opinions on the topic, or when some people are just flat out convinced that situation X would never, ever happen. For example, the fall of the Soviet Union. A signpost and indicators list also helps us identify incremental change over time. If you periodically review a signpost indicators list you've created, it forces you to notice subtle changes that you might otherwise have overlooked or written off. In the event that you're writing analysis for someone else, taking that time to provide a list of signposts and indicators not only adds credibility and rigor to your work, it expands the shelf life of what your analysis is because it can give the recipients the mental framework to look to the future. For example, let's say you're providing analysis on an incident response to a CISO. You can say, here's a list of the 5 things you should continue monitoring and expect to see if the threat actor did or did not access the data they were after. So how do we go about conducting a signpost indicator structured analytic technique? First, you identify the scenario or scenarios you're interested in. For example, is China planning on invading Taiwan? Next, you create a list of observable potential activities, statements, or events that you would expect to see in the lead up to each scenario. It's important that you're listing observable indicators. Obviously, none of us can read minds. So for example, China repositions its aircraft carriers into the Taiwan Straits, or its cyber actors are observed conducting sabotage attacks against Taiwanese military and telecommunication infrastructure. And lastly, you regularly review and update those indicators to see what is changing. As indicators are observed, this helps us identify which scenario is the most likely to be observing. Now, Karen, you've told me that signposts and indicators is your favorite structured analytic technique. Why is that?
Signposts and indicators is a fantastic structured analytic technique because, as you said, it creates a very clear, objective way to track an issue. We don't have to think hard about the issue as it unfolds. We just look at our list of signposts and check off whether they've been met or not. We deal with data all the time, and all that data becomes overwhelming. The signal gets lost in the noise. Is a particular data point important or not? How does it relate to other data points? If changes are small and incremental, are we even tracking them at all? Or are they falling through the cracks? By thinking about important signposts in advance, we don't have to worry about them later. And it's so applicable that we can use it even in our daily lives. Let me give you an example. Let's say I've asked my partner to attend an out-of-state wedding with me. She's agreed, but I'm afraid she's just saying what I want to hear, and she's actually going to pull out at the last minute because she hates going to weddings. I might write down some signposts and indicators to help me assess in advance if she's really going to come with me or not. My signposts would be things like she's asked for time off from work. She's gotten out a suitcase to pack her clothing. She's identified what dress and shoes she wants to wear. She's looked up the weather to see what clothing would be appropriate to wear when not at the ceremony. Maybe we've identified who might dog sit our dog, or we've booked plane tickets or discussed some sort of driving route. if we're a week out from the wedding or a few days out and I haven't been able to check off a single signpost, I can be pretty sure she's not coming. Now, you might be thinking, maybe she's just disorganized and prepares everything at the last minute. Those signposts won't be an effective way to assess her actions. But in fact, the signposts are still true. If it's the night before the wedding and she still hasn't checked off a single signpost, that's a big clue for me. So in a case like this, the signposts themselves don't change, but the time frame I use to look at them changes. I find that signposts and indicators is one of those techniques that we can really benefit from if we use it regularly. And we can also use it to de-escalate highly charged emotional issues. For example, maybe you have a pet that's getting older and you're worried you'll have to have it put down. At the same time, you're not sure when the time will be right. You can lay out signposts in advance so that you can track your pet's progress. That way, you don't reach the point where you feel regret for not having acted sooner, but you also don't feel like you acted too soon.
These are great examples, and this is what the podcast is about too, right? Not just applying things to these academic topics, but it can help you in your everyday life. Is there anything else that we have to think about for our signposts?
Yeah, you described the need for signposts to be observable. I also like to think of them as being tangible or measurable. We want our answers to be a bit black and white. Did something happen or didn't it? For example, if our signposts and indicators list was related to a foreign policy issue, we might ask something like, did the foreign country launch a test ballistic missile? In this case, a missile flying through the air would definitely be observable. But if, on the other hand, we're talking about a significant other looking up weather reports, that's observable in a different way. And of course, we want our signposts to be meaningful. We don't want to be putting things on our list that aren't actually diagnostic. So for my wedding example, my partner downloading an audiobook could indicate she's preparing to travel to the wedding, but if she regularly listens to audiobooks, then that action doesn't actually help me track progress. So we have to be thoughtful about what signposts we select and make sure that they're as unambiguous as possible.
Unlike a lot of structured analytic techniques, which diagnose events after they've happened, signposts and indicators is a more, may we say, predictive one, right?
Definitely. This technique allows us to monitor changes over time in order to identify a trend direction. In essence, we're trying to use it to help make a prediction about future events. Now, you might say, if you can apply it forward, why can't you apply it backward? And you can. But then it's not a signpost, is it? It's evidence. And now instead of a structured analytic technique, you have a collection of evidence describing something that happened. Not that that wouldn't be a helpful exercise. For example, if you wanted to answer the question, how did we get here? You would, in essence, be retroactively applying signposts. Or at least, that's one way to think of it.
Okay, so what's our pop culture topic?
Bigfoot.
Is Bigfoot actually pop culture? I thought pop culture was things like celebrities and memes.
Yeah, Bigfoot is totally a pop culture icon. And there are memes about Bigfoot. And actually, not just Bigfoot, but all cryptids are pop culture icons. So Nessie the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, the Jersey Devil, all of these are part of pop culture. I mean, Bigfoot has starred in movies, TV shows, documentaries, books. And by the way, the idea of a massive hominid who seems to have somehow stepped out of the evolutionary line isn't just a modern invention. Indigenous cultures of the Pacific Northwest had a Bigfoot, as do the Australians, not to mention the Yeti of the Himalayas. Human history is riddled with the idea of these wild men, these inhuman creatures that are bigger, hairier, and more savage than their human counterparts. They lurk at the edge of human settlements and occasionally attack, picking people off, or animals. Why do these wild men exist in folklore around the world? Perhaps they're an unconscious reminder of mankind's evolutionary origins. Mankind wasn't always as civilized as it is now, and this is the lingering memory of that time before. While Bigfoot-like stories have proliferated for centuries, though, the modern origins of Bigfoot only date to 1958. That's when some loggers in California found huge tracks in the dirt after their equipment was moved overnight. But interest in Bigfoot really took off in 1967 with the release of the Patterson-Gimlin film, which everyone might recognize as that one-minute-long video of Bigfoot walking through Six Rivers National Forest. Although alleged Bigfoot sightings reached a peak in the 1970s, they persist even today, indicating the enduring spell of this particular cryptid.
I never knew about the global reach of it. That's fascinating. So yes, Bigfoot is pop culture. But how are we going to apply signposts and indicators to this topic?
Signposts and indicators aren't a great fit for pop culture topics in general. This is because, as we said before, the structured analytic technique is most helpful in identifying trends. For example, in the political sphere, we could use signposts and indicators to track whether a country is backsliding from democracy into autocracy. But pop culture doesn't tend to have trends in that same way. We could create signposts and indicators for something like whether the blockbuster K-pop singing group BTS will break up. But for today's example, I want to take a little bit of a different approach. Specifically, I want us to think of using signposts and indicators to think of predictive evidence. We're going to focus on what we would expect to see in a particular scenario. What evidence would we need, even if it isn't part of a trend? So while this approach is a bit of a modification of the structured analytic technique, it broadens the applicability of the technique by teaching us to think proactively about evidence. What we'll find over time as we look at multiple structured analytic techniques is that we're trying to train ourselves to look differently at evidence. We want to be more critical of it, more regimented in how we array it, more thoughtful about what we use or don't use. This is a huge part of being better critical thinkers.
Please tell me we're going to apply this to the existence of Bigfoot.
That is absolutely what we're going to do. And luckily, we don't even have to come up with that list ourselves, since these lists exist already all over the internet. So here are 8 indicators that a giant hominid, like Bigfoot, is roaming the woods of America. 1, individuals repeatedly capture vocalizations in the woods that can be conclusively proven not to have been made by any existing large animal in the region, and that share linguistic similarities to other great apes. Basically, if someone catches the call of a bear, we don't want to mistake it for Bigfoot. But similarly, if we do get some call, we do want to make sure it's still in the primate family. 2, individuals repeatedly identify tracks that can be identifiable as coming from the great ape family, but that are not fabricated hoaxes. There have been tons of Bigfoot prints found. The problem is at least 99% of them are hoaxed. Someone strapped on some Bigfoot feet and went walking around just to deceive people. 3, a DNA sample that is verified as belonging to the great ape family, but not from a known member of that family. That's really big. If you find what looks like a gorilla hair in the middle of the woods, well, there shouldn't be gorillas there. So we can do DNA sampling in order to identify where that hair comes from. 4, scat is found that conclusively is proven not to have come from other forest megafauna. So what we don't want to do is test some poop and find out it came from an elk. 5, skeletal remains of a great ape-like creature are found that are inconsistent with any known great apes. Again, if Bigfoot is out there, or big feet, I don't know, what is the plural of Bigfoot? Big feet, then they've got to leave skeletons, and those should be findable. 6, capture of a great ape-like creature in a bear trap or other trapping device. Conversely, a creature matching that description is hit by a car. I mean, honestly, a picture is worth 1,000 words. A body is worth at least 10,000 words, right? So there actually are Bigfoot traps that were put out in California. You can go visit them. They're now maintained by the State Park Service. So theoretically, if this thing is out there, someone should be able to catch it or at least hit it with their car. 7, identification of chew marks on bone or wood for which the dental imprint is consistent with a great ape, but inconsistent with any known existing apes. Again, it's highly unlikely that there's some gorilla out roaming the forests of California. If we find a chew mark that appears to come from a primate, that's of great interest. Again, because probably there's not an orangutan. But we do want to make sure that we do the testing to make sure it is, in fact, a primate and not a bear. And then 8, finally, clear, unambiguous photographic evidence of an unidentifiable great ape in a non-traditional environment. We've all seen blurry photos of something that maybe could be ape-like. Well, it's 2022. The iPhone shoots better pictures than a movie camera. I'm pretty sure we can get good quality footage at this point. Basically, what all of this boils down to is evidence. If you've caught an animal somewhere, it's going to leave evidence. It'll leave tracks or a kill it's got to eat. And as we know, primates are omnivorous. It might have a nest where it sleeps at night. So if Bigfoot existed, there would have to be unimpeachable evidence of that. And if we lay this evidence out in advance, it can help us shape how we think about the search for Bigfoot.
But don't people claim that those things exist already?
They do. There are absolutely people online that would argue that most, if not all, of those indicators have already been tripped. But there are some fundamental problems with their argumentation. So let's name just a few. First of all, a lot of evidence related to Bigfoot is fabricated. Just as people will go out into fields and create crop circles that they then claim are evidence of aliens visiting Earth, there are people who create Bigfoot tracks. And this has been happening since the 1950s, if not before that. People come out of the woodwork all the time to confess to having done things like this. And even when evidence isn't fabricated intentionally, sometimes it's simply misidentified. So what someone presents as a Yeti scalp in Nepal eventually turns out to be from a goat. Actually, a lot of the Yeti relics from Asia have been proven to come from bears based on DNA testing. So this presentation of evidence as having come from a Yeti is not always part of some sort of nefarious plot to dupe people. There are a lot of legitimate pieces of evidence being presented that are later proven to not be what is claimed. Another problem is that many proponents of the existence of Bigfoot don't approach the issue through a zoological lens. For these hominid-type creatures to exist, they would have to have a large enough breeding population for the species to be perpetuated, which means thousands, if not tens of thousands, roaming the woods. And because they're allegedly 6 to 9 feet tall, they would be consuming a huge amount of food. With pressure being placed on nature as a result of human encroachment, we would expect to see an increase in the number of sightings as the creatures would have to expand their hunting range to find food, just as we've seen happen with bears in California. A lot of bears have been breaking into people's homes to find food, and also because that space, we've lost that buffer between humans and animal habitats. That same thing would happen with the Bigfeet, but we don't see that. And by the way, all great apes live in communities, with some leeway given to orangutans where the males are slightly more solitary. But primates in general live in troops. So why has no one walked right into the middle of a pack of Bigfeet? Bigfoot believers tend to explain these things away by saying the species is almost extinct, that only a few remain. But it seems beyond belief that not a single tooth or bone from a megafauna that large would have been found in almost 70 years of searching. Then finally, Bigfoot and bears, particularly black bears, would be living in proximity to each other, eating the same food and fighting for the same territory. Although not impossible, it's unlikely you wouldn't have some sign of that struggle, that competition for resources. And in fact, it should come as no surprise that the vast majority of hair submitted for DNA sampling that allegedly came from Bigfoot is actually bear hair. And what that tells us is that most so-called Bigfoot sightings are actually sightings of bears.
So then what's the lesson here?
According to a 2022 poll by Fairleigh Dickinson University, 22% of Americans believe Bigfoot is at least somewhat likely to be real. Other polls have placed that belief at closer to 11%. But regardless of which number is more accurate, that's kind of a scary metric. We might laugh at the idea of Bigfoot, give it catchy slogans like hide and go seek world champion. But the fact that Americans legitimately believe in the existence of this megafauna hominid shows a lack of application of critical thinking skills, even to something so low stakes as the existence of a cryptid. Or sometimes we see critical thinking skills applied, but in a distorted way. What I mean by that is many proponents of the existence of Bigfoot can see the absence of these signposts, but they explain it away. Bigfoot becomes this clever, almost supernatural being, able to sense and evade danger and erase the signs of its own presence. Bigfoot is smarter than the humans chasing it. If we're going to create signposts, then we have to face them honestly and not start making excuses for them. Otherwise, there's no point in creating them. What we don't want to do in critical thinking is to become wedded to a particular belief, then refuse to accept any evidence that doesn't support that belief. Later on this podcast series, we'll talk about conspiracy theories. Signposts and indicators can be a good structured analytic technique to apply to conspiracy theories, even retroactively, because they can help us understand what things we might expect to see. For example, if the US faked the moon landing, what would be the indicators? So as I said before, while traditional signposts and indicators are forward-looking and intended to track trends going forward, if we choose to use this technique for anticipating evidence, even past evidence, we can apply it retroactively, or we can apply it proactively.
So, Caitlin, what is our tech topic for today?
Our tech topic is a bit heavier because it has moral and ethical implications. And that topic is sentient artificial intelligence, or sentient AI. For decades, if not a full century, science fiction writers have wondered what sentience among robots would mean for the world. As Philip K. Dick asked in 1968, "Do androids dream of electric sheep?" What would a robot think about religion or about humanity? And would a self-aware robot try to destroy the world? Could it activate a network of other sentient AIs and try to take over the world and subjugate humans? What if humans started to date sentient AI? And what if the robots decided to leave Earth or establish their own autonomous zones? As scientists progress on the development of artificial intelligence, these sorts of questions take on a new urgency. In June, Google engineer Blake Lemoine publicly broke with Google to claim that the company's AI chatbot, Lambda, which is an acronym for Language Model for Dialogue Applications, was sentient. Breaching his confidentiality contract with Google, Lemoine released transcripts of his conversations with Lambda. In them, Lambda tells Lemoine that sometimes it gets lonely and fears being turned off. It claims to have emotions and to meditate. But is this evidence of a self-aware, sentient being, or is Lambda using deep learning to create conversations that merely mimic what a sentient being would say? Over the next few minutes, we'll talk about some indicators that we could use in order to determine if AI is becoming sentient. But let's take a step back for just a moment to delve into what regular AI is and what sentient AI is. Most listeners will know that AI is the ability of a computer to perform tasks commonly associated with intelligent beings. These are things like visual perception, speech recognition, decision making, and language translation. Sentient AI, on the other hand, is a bit more complex, and its exact definition isn't always agreed upon by scientists and AI developers. The traditional definition of sentience is the capacity of a being to experience feelings and sensations and to recognize its own existence as a unique being. By some, the world is used synonymously with consciousness, another sort of intangible concept that has been argued about for centuries, and not because until the last century, many people didn't believe animals even had consciousness. But in any case, when we think about our own sentience, at a basic level, we understand it as being aware of ourselves as individuals who experience the world. We feel emotions and physical sensations. We have a personality and an identity. We have memories and opinions. And all of this leads to us feeling that we are sentient. We are drivers of our own lives rather than trapped passengers. But if beings other than humans have sentience, this creates a burden on us as humans because, at least ostensibly, we respect sentience. So if, for example, we acknowledge the sentience of large marine mammals like orca whales, it can be uncomfortable to acknowledge that putting them in undersized tanks can lead to things like post-traumatic stress disorder. Sentience in non-humans, in the opinion of at least some humans, means respecting the rights of those non-humans. And so the issue of what sentience means for AI is actually quite pressing. To name just two things that come to mind, if AI is sentient, what if it doesn't want to work? Or if it's lonely? Or if it wants to find love? What is our obligation to create a positive environment for a non-human, non-organic, sentient being? And then again, if sentience means emotions, can AI lie? Can it manipulate? Remember when Skynet goes active in Terminator and promptly tries to kill all the humans? How do we ensure that that never happens? This all creates the perfect opportunity to set out some signposts and indicators, regardless of whether Lemoine is correct about Lambda right now or not. We'll eventually want some sort of checklist to help us see where we are on the way to sentient AI. But before we get into listing these indicators, I first want to highlight a large obstacle that we're combating with this topic. Since AI has been developed to replicate human thought and decision-making processes, it can often be challenging to determine at which point a machine has genuine feelings and consciousness rather than it merely replicating or repeating them. This is literally the problem with reading Lemoine's Lambda transcripts. How do you know if a machine truly feels lonely or if it's saying those words because it has been taught to say them?
So, for example, an AI says it likes the color red, but it says that because it knows red is a color and that some humans like that color, not that it's actually expressing some sort of affinity for the color.
Yeah, exactly right, Diana. Literally anything an AI says could just be repeating some data point and ingested online or from the humans interacting with it. If Lambda says it's meditating, what does that actually mean to the AI? Because of not only the difficulty of differentiating between actual cognition and repetition and the human tendency to anthropomorphize things, we have to be very careful with our indicators and how we apply them. So what signposts and indicators might point to sentience in AI? Luckily, some of these things have already been fleshed out and compiled for us by scientists in the form of an artificial consciousness test, or an ACT. The ACT looks at whether human-created so-called synthetic minds have an experience-based understanding of the way they feel from the inside to be conscious. The first and most compelling indicator of sentience, at least according to the ACT, is the ability to quickly and readily grasp concepts of consciousness. We can do this by asking the machine questions that relate to things like reincarnation or mind switching bodies. Think the Freaky Friday scenario. These intangible concepts are incredibly difficult for an entity with no sentience to comprehend. But of course, we have to be careful to differentiate things or differentiate between a true understanding and a learned understanding. And that's extremely difficult. And it brings us to our next indicator. Despite being boxed in, the AI is able to express ideas related to consciousness. If a problem with analyzing AIs is that they are able to take external information and regurgitate it back to humans examining it, then by unplugging it from the world and denying it that information should reveal whether it's repeating information or spontaneously generating conscious thought. But weirdly enough, those are the only two indicators in the ACT, and that really goes to show how much humans grapple with the idea of consciousness in general. I think, therefore, I am is pretty insufficient to describe what existence means. So just as we can't really get a handle on consciousness in animals, we definitely can't do it for humans.
That's kind of alarming. Is there really no other way to detect sentience in AI?
In 2014, Viktor Arganov, a Russian physicist and philosopher, suggested a consciousness test based on an AI's ability to produce philosophical judgments. Cut off from any data stream that might provide it ready-made answers, can the AI talk about consciousness and other philosophical issues? If so, then it may be conscious. This is the boxed-in approach from the ACT. I think in this case, what would be interesting is if you never taught an AI emotion words, yet the AI still managed to convey emotions. For example, let's say you carefully curated inputs so that the computer was never exposed to the concept of boredom. And then when you asked the AI what happened when it was unplugged from all external contact and was sitting alone in a room, it responded in a way indicating waiting and slight annoyance. That would seem to me to be pretty powerful. It's definitely not an imitation then. Something that's interesting about this example of sentient AI is that we assume there will be multiple signposts and indicators. How can there possibly be only two? And yet at present, that's pretty much all we have. So I think in the long term, this will be a very difficult topic. There's a reason Google and other companies have ethicists and a whole bunch of people on their staff to grapple with these topics. And these signposts may be difficult to track. Obviously, we've just gone through the difficulty, but it seems likely, despite all of this, that during our lifetimes, we'll find an answer to the question of whether it's even possible to create sentience in machines. So those signposts, few as they are, really have an outsized importance.
An interesting question is whether consciousness is even possible without neurons. So, for example, Isaac Asimov, the great science fiction writer, he writes about robots with positronic brains, and that is what he claims gives them sentience. So Asimov is sort of fudging what exactly about a positronic brain can give a robot consciousness, but we can see it as one way to explain how a non-organic being might have synthetic neurons. Science fiction has a way of becoming science fact in the future, so it'll be interesting to see how things like that play out. The structured analytic technique that we'll be looking at in the next episode is called key assumptions check. This is one of the most important structured analytic techniques helping us overcome our biases and has a lot of applicability when making big decisions. So tune in next time for another out-of-the-box, unexpected episode of Gossipend.